Okay, so let's get started. So today we're going to discuss geodesics in Schwarzschild, the Schwarzschild geometry that we obtain. We're going to draw some key observations and then slowly begin to connect with some issues that the coordinates that we have chosen or that we ended up with describing our geometry are not necessarily the ideal ones to discuss at least some features of what's going on in that space-time, and then that will lead us into what we discuss the next class, which will be to fix that. But even with that, we can do plenty because of, as we discuss, the radius at which problems arise, at least even in the context of just having a coordinate singularity, would be too deep inside, say, the sun. And we're going to be thinking that today we're thinking about tests that we can do in the sun. And imagining that we take the limit as we get closer to that coordinate singularity, and then discuss a little bit of what the issues are. So we're going to be following primarily in this discussion walls. I mean, Carol's is excellent, it's very good, but I think it's just too much of spoon feeding the students. Like, in some sense, he's taking it that you have never taken classical mechanics in some sense. So it's just really taking you by the hand. I have plenty of confidence that you guys can absorb walls way. And if you don't, then okay, ask me questions. But then just take a look at Carol's. Carol's is very detailed, but not maybe a bit too verbose. But the situations are, I mean, the discussions are very good in both. So I'm just going to go to walls because we go much more directly into the results. But for that, I need to kind of come back to something I said we were going to get to when we need it. We already kind of anticipated a little bit this discussion last class, where we say, well, suppose you have a geodesic, here, and if we write it in terms of the four momenta, we can derive this equation, and then after your question, so this equation has two components, right? So it has essentially the derivative along the path. This is just how that vector is changing due to kind of how it how the curve is varying, but that's a curve in a manifold that could be also be kind of modified by the curvature of the manifold itself, and that's what this contribution is. So we derive just straightforwardly this equation, but then we noted that if now along a specific coordinate, let's say, which we call b under bar, remember when I said, well, whenever we need it, if we're speaking about a specific coordinate, we're going to use under bars. So up to this point, this b was completely general, but if I say, well, but there is a coordinate, maybe we adapted our coordinate system that way, where all the metric components, when we take the partial derivative with respect to that coordinate, evaluate to zero, so they have no explicit dependence on that coordinate, then we'll have a zero, which will then tell us that this thing is non-varying along the curve, which, okay, we remind ourselves that it's a geodesic. And so we're saying that the component of the four momentum along that component is constant. So let's just describe that a little bit more as we always do. We noted something in a very specific choice of coordinate, but let's just try to think about more in covariant terms to recover this thing. We were saying, well, suppose, let's just pick this one. So what is this for us? Remember, that's a vector that is the gradient along that coordinate, so let's just make it more explicit what we mean by that. And okay, if we think about vectors, our notation would say, okay, this really has a supra index A because that's a vector. It's along a specific component, but that's what it is. So let's give this a name, AA. We're going to assume it's normalized. And for the following reason, this PB would be covariantly now expressed as the product of our KA with our PA. So KA, we're assuming K is normalized. And the reason we want it normalized is because when we do the product of K with P, we don't want to add stuff to it related to the normalization or the magnitude of the vector K. So this would be our our constant. As this vector constructed this way will single out this component. And if we haven't adapted our coordinates so that one of them is aligned with respect to these special coordinates that the metric has no dependence on, okay, well, now this contraction will do it for us. Is that clear?
Wait, sorry, I don't quite understand.
So where are you up to? So where to here? Okay. Okay, so what we did, so but just to refresh our memory, the one option that we could have done is there is a coordinate that we see the metric not depending at all whatsoever with respect to it. So naturally, we think that has to be a symmetry because this is true, and as to that, then we can determine this. So, but that kind of, in some sense, told us we have a coordinate system that we align it such that one of those coordinates happen to be that B. An example would be in the Schwarzschild case, the T that we chose. Remember, I also showed, well, you could shovel it with some other coordinate that would have a time dependence explicitly shown in there, which was a fake time dependence. But then in that case, we wouldn't be using that time. But if we take our standard coordinates, we'll say ddt is 1. That means a ddt is our vector. We also know that using those coordinates, that pt would be conserved using that argument. But now suppose you know that, you come in and shuffle the coordinates in the same thing, in the same way we did. We just introduce another coordinate t prime that has some dependence. Okay, so now this is not going to be evident. But if you recall that this was your vector, and you express that vector in whatever coordinates you want, it will still be the case that the full p dotted with that vector will still be constant along the geodesic.
Okay, which vector is this? This vector?
This vector is, in this case, is this one. It's whatever vector you had the symmetry associated with.
Oh.
So I take that vector, and now think of it in general coordinates. Remember that vector was such that this was satisfied, but now we're just trying to say, it's something we knew, was very explicit to think about it in terms of those specific coordinates, but now let's just covariantize it so that we can discuss any arbitrary coordinate. Of course, now in those arbitrary coordinates, this vector will have a much more complicated expression, but it still is the same vector, right? And so out of that, this product keeps singling out for us the same component along the geodesic that will be constant along it. So we're just simply saying how to kind of make this covariant so that we can use it more generally.
Should the K have a lower B bar index? K, A, B bar?
So if you want, for labeling, you could put a B here. But we're saying away, we're saying, okay, we have a number of Killing fields associated to it. We might give them different names when we get to it, and we'll do that in a second. But this is just, no, we're keeping it generic. So now we can recall that again, the PA. Thread A of PB, that's 0, because we're talking about a geodesic. But we also know that PA, thread A of PB, AB is 0, because that's a constant. We just said, if K happens to be the vector associated to that symmetry, the product of these two is just singling out that component, and we're just kind of expressing that condition in a covariant way. And now we can then do one more step. It's just use Leibniz here, and this will be the same as PA dot A of PB times KB plus PA PB dot A KB that has to be equal to 0. So we just simply acted with the covariant derivative first on the P and then on the K. So, but this is 0 due to our geodesic equation, which then that means that this is 0. But if this is 0, let me just write it in a slightly different way, but completely equivalent. So now, let's discuss this. We can always kind of refer to other things that we have introduced for different contexts, but the same intuition applies. Let me ignore this for a time, for a second. This is a 0-2 tensor, right? A 0-2 tensor we discussed, we could write in terms of like, its symmetric and its anti-symmetric part. But what we're multiplying with here is completely symmetric. I can flip A and B and still get the same equation. So this is implying, and of course these are non-zero. So this implies that grad A, AB symmetric part, we don't know anything about the anti-symmetric part because the anti-symmetric part of this vector when multiplied by this would be completely gone. It's zero. And this is known as the Killing's equation, or someone named Killing, but again, in some kind of fate of life, I mean, that name is associated with something that annihilates a product in, along the geodesic. So, and it's funny, there's, I mean, people just using this, there's a maiming equation as well, but which is almost satisfying as zero, but let's just keep it on the Killing side.
When we derived the Killing equation in tutorial, we did it in sort of like a pre-interpretive way.
Okay.
And we only did it to first order, and we got this.
Aldo, do you remember
that?
Oh, okay. This is just from the point of view of the symmetry, how they arise,
yeah,
with respect to a small change in your coordinates.
Yeah.
This it's the same.
Yeah, this seems like it's more general, so it's not perturbative.
They are intrinsically connected, the two. But yeah, maybe we can discuss this again in the tutorial. But this is okay. This is the Killing's equation for us from this point of view. And then as you might have discussed then, this is, if you know all the Killing vectors in your space-time, then okay, that's very powerful. How many there are, it's impossible to know from the get-go. I mean, it's, and sometimes if you're sufficiently large space-times, you're gonna have more Killing fields that you can find than, say, unknowns in your metric. But that's because not all of them are independent. So it's when you have them, it's very useful to have them. But if you're set up to find all of them, you could just spend a lot of time. And so it's hard to know when to stop. But so we're gonna, for the most part, in what we discuss next, we're just gonna be looking at the obvious ones and then getting things associated to them. Any questions here?
Well, maybe to organize the logic. So just to be clear, so first we found that P, B bar was conserved. That was the first claim we found, right? In a special coordinate, there's going to be the component of that quantity along the special coordinate is going to be conserved over time.
Sure.
Then we said, oh, we can obtain this component in a clever way. We're going to find the vector field along the special coordinate. We're going to call it del B bar.
Yep.
Which has components KA.
That's vector, we're gonna denote it with vector k.
Yeah.
But if you want, is zeros, if you have chosen your coordinates that way,
yeah,
zeros with exception of
a
one and the special and the normalization. But let's say it will have a non-zero component only along B bar.
Yeah. But we decided, well, the general coordinates, that's where we keep a general k. Otherwise, it will be some sort of delta, direct delta, right? It will be delta A B bar.
Right. That's right. So we want to say now, let's just make it covariant so that because we don't need to be restricted to choosing those coordinates. And so then the covariant way of expressing what we just said is just say there is a vector k, which in a special coordinate system is your delta. But now, if we consider the product of the p with the k, that's what we're doing. If we happen to be in the same coordinate system, it will give us the pb bar. If not, it just tells us this is the right projection.
Yeah. So we found a clever way to get PB bar in a certain sense.
We find, it's not necessarily the clever, so this is our rules. We live and die by the covariant principle, right? This is what generativity is.
So we wrote it in a general coordinate, let's say. Then we wrote P bar in a general, an expression in general coordinate.
Yeah, exactly.
So now, and then we say, okay, since we know that it's conserved, we say, okay, take the derivative with respect to time, which is this PA, take that.
So this says that this product along the geodesic is conserved, so it's zero. So that's what we're doing here.
Because you included it before, right? You included
That's right, exactly. So we just retell the story from the covariant point of view.
Now in general coordinates. And we found for this to be true, the symmetric part of that covariant derivative must be zero.
Exactly. And that's the Killing equations, and that any vector in your space time that satisfies that, then there is a symmetry associated to it, and then we can do something with it. And that's what we're going to do now.
And one thing in the tutorial we also saw.
Say again, sorry.
That in the tutorial we also saw that when the metric does not depend on a specific coordinate, it means that it's very simple to write the associated Killing method.
Right. So which is what we did there, right? So if it doesn't depend, so when we write Schwarzschild, let's say when we look at Schwarzschild again. Okay, so first thing we see that the metric does not depend on t. So we do have a Killing factor, let's call it k, which is d dt, which is d dta. And we could plug it in here, and we're going to have the right condition. There's another one that is obvious as well. Let's call it, I don't know, phi. Or however I should pronounce that thing. D phi A. I phi. Of course we have more because this is the sphere. Remember, we ask the sphere to our R equal constants to be just regular sphere. So we have all the Killing fields associated with these ones, and they are three. We're only using one if you want. That's because, well, in spherical symmetry, let's say we have a vector. We can try and maintain constant the direction and this magnitude. And so we're going to just, in the analysis, we're going to simplify things. We're going to just take a plane, the theta equal I over 2 plane. We have perfect symmetry here. So whatever that plane is, we can always flip it around. And the same will be true. So we're just taking one of them. And this will be the Killing field that we're going to use. But let's start with the very first observation that we can do, which relates to something that we've done or we discussed the very first class of this course. So take, and we're going to imagine somewhere that there is, at some radius, let's call it R1, someone emits a signal that has frequency omega 1. And then it's going to be received by someone sitting in R2. This is related to your question. It was emitted here, but the observer actually sees it over there, precisely along the null cone that kind of connects them. But you have to be careful that this is curved. So it's just drawing this line straight it's an abuse of whatever graph or whatever. It gets here with omega W2 at that radius. So we want to now establish what is the redshift, or how is the change of frequencies as this photon, if you want, is trying to climb up out of the potential if it happens to be that R1 is smaller than R2. So we're going to now use all these things. So first, part of the reason we measure two things is because this, we have an observer here and we have another observer there. So the observer will have tangent UA. We could, if you want, we can put a sub-index I just to say observer 1, observer 2. But any observer measures even a vector ka, that is the tangent to the curve, that null curve that the photon traverses, the frequency omega, and let's call it sub I for whatever that observer sees, is given by ua ka.
Sorry, what's ua again?
So ua is the tangent to, it's the observer. the tangent that the observer carries. So if the observer is at rest, it measures something. If the observer happens to be moving with some velocity, we're going to have two effects, the standard Doppler effect by the effect observer moving, and the gravitational effect that we're about to get. But of course, then we're going to simplify, and we're going to assume these two observers are at rest. There's no velocity associated to their trajectory. And okay, the frequency is this one. Okay, we have chosen our signature minus plus plus plus. So we know that sitting in the four vector associated to the null trajectory that a photon follows, we have sitting in the time component, it's energy. Sitting in the space component, it's momenta. But of course, it has to be null, so it's a trivial relation between this time and space. And if you look at k0 has omega sitting in the first component times h bar. We're ignoring h bar for the time being for this argument. And so this is the frequency. OK, so now this is what we have to do. But notice, maybe I shouldn't, well, we're going to use, let's call this vector. So I'm going to call it here for the sake of just not confusing with that. Okay, this is our killing field that we're going to choose. So that guy, we know that set A, that's our killing vector, dotted with the momenta of the photon, Ka, has to be constant. OK, that's not what the observer is measuring, but it's almost what the observer is measuring, because UA, of course, saying it's an observer. First, recall what this thing is. We have coordinates dxa, d tau, along the trajectories. So the xa of, imagine xa of tau is the curve associated to each observer. We have x1 and x2. And the tangent to it is the vector ua. And so this has to be normalized. But we're imagining it's a rest, so we have something here and then zero everywhere else. Let me denote it that way. We have no motion in our spatial part of the coordinates. We have something here, but it has to be normalized. So if you want, you can call this u0 to be determined. And we have ua equal minus 1, which is the same thing as ua, ub, dab. But because of this assumption, we only have u0 square dtt equal to minus 1. We can follow this through. This would be u0 square times 1 minus 2m over r with a minus sign in front equal to minus 1. Simplify the minus and obtain that u0 is 1 over the square root of 1 minus 2m over r. So that should be the only relevant component of the vector u for our calculation. So now we're going to then just put these things.
What does the minus sign signify?
Second?
U not equal to minus 1 over square root of.
No, because I cancel it.
No. You have u squared is equal to that. What is the?
Oh, you're saying there would be a plus and minus.
What does the minus signify?
So one is where you're going, to the future or to the past. So it's the rate of change of your coordinate. But great question. I should have said that. Of your coordinates, if our coordinate is ticking positively as we move t positively, so that we choose that. That's our convention. Thank you. OK, so we know these. We know dA is dVt. And we have just determined that u0, or if you want ua, the full vector, happens to be 1 over square root of 1 minus 2m over r dDt. But dDt is this one, so let's call it zA. So that's true. And so from there, we know that ZA, C, or however you want to call it, 1 minus 2m over r, ua. So now I can use that and say, oh, we wanted to compute and relate omega I, which we defined to be minus ka za, but that's using this is minus ka, or let me just put it this way, minus ka square root of 1 minus 2m over r. UA. Yes.
UA is the velocity of the photon, right?
The UA, no, it's not the photon, it's the observer. KA is the photon.
Okay. Hey, sorry, how did we?
No, this is constant. So we know that the constant is that, and it will be the same for both R1 and R2. That's that. It's this, but this combination is our omega. Right? So we have that for all observers sitting at whatever radii that is met. That is measuring this frequency, this combination has to stay constant. So let me just let's go back and make connection with that R1 and R2. So that means that omega 1 over square root of, sorry, omega 1 times the square root of 1 minus 2m over R1 has to be equal to omega 2 times square root of 1 minus 2m over R2. Which means omega 1 over omega 2 is square root of 1 minus 2m over r2 divided by square root of 1 minus 2m over r1.
Can you tell one more time why UA should be aligned to killing vector?
Why the UA? So, okay, let's just, there are two different things. So first, this is the killing vector. Now we're choosing an observer. It's the observer that will measure the frequency of the photon. We can choose any observer we want that sits at R1 and our observer that sits at R2, that is the one receiving the photon. And again, great question. So you could have chosen any observer will do. We just want to make sure that we try and make sure that we make the calculation the cleanest. And if that this observer were to have any relative velocity, any velocity whatsoever, and this velocity is different from here and there, we're going to have, as a result, a frequency change that will depend both on the position or where they are in the gravitational field and how they are moving. So those will also be part of the contribution. So we choose, in order to make the cleanest calculation, say have both observers be at rest. They are sitting on R1 and R2, they're just progressing, and then they will measure any change that they measure will only blame it on the fact that this photon move in a gravitational field.
So we're choosing our observer to be on a geodesic.
In a geodesic that happens to be at rest.
Yeah.
That's no velocity. Otherwise, we would have had components here. We would have had that velocity be part of the calculation. And then the result would have also depended on whatever velocity we decide this observer to have here and this observer to have here. But we're just trying to get only the contribution due to the gravitational field. And of course, if we build something here, not only will it depend on the velocity, but also will depend on the position. So we're going to have that mixed up. So the velocities themselves would see that they are moving at two different places in the gravitational field. We're just keeping the cleanest possible. Yes?
Over there, k is a killing vector.
Yes.
And the statement that the dot product of killing vector along any geodesic is right, but xi is another killing vector and xi k.
No, so hold on. I maybe that went too fast. Ka, I mean, I don't know what letter to use. Ka happened to be the tangent to the null trajectory along which the photon is moving. This one has nothing to do with a Killing vector. We call it kappa. This is capital K. So if you want, we can change this to, I don't know, F or PA for the photon. So this is just the photon trajectory, or the tangent to the photon trajectory. So the only one that is gives us a constant is, and of course it traverses a geodesic. So the tangent to the geodesic times the Killing vector, that's our constant.
So now I understand this, but not that, because a Killing vector along a geodesic is constant.
The Killing vector, so hold on, the Killing vector along the geodesic is not constant. The product of the tangent to the geodesic with the Killing vector is a constant.
Yes. But now Ka is not a Killing vector. So why is the dot product giving me something like frequency?
So, great. First thing is, let's ignore everything about Killing vector. We don't need to know that even that exists. If I'm an observer and I see a photon passing by, and I happen to say, and I happen to know what the tangent to that photon is, the frequency I would measure due to my own motion is the product of that my u with the tangent to the geodesics. My tangent with the tangent to the geodesics, that's what it is. And if you want, you can go back to our covariant rule that we live by. If we were in special relativity and we are an observer is sitting at rest, our u will be just ddt. K will be, if we think of K in special relativity as h bar omega, and then here h bar omega with a vector, right? So that it will give us a zero, because the tangent would have zero norm, because it's a null tangent, it's a null vector. Then we say, well, if we're trying to measure the frequency, we will just look at this first component. Operationally, that in covariant terms and using our principle, our equivalence principles would be, okay, take your tangent, dot it with k, and that's what you would call frequency. Of course, we're shoving in the minus sign to remember that this product would have chosen a minus plus 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 signature. So that's our frequency, our covariant definition of a frequency. This is something that is done completely local, so it's perfectly consistent with all our rules. So that's that.
If it wasn't at rest, that wouldn't be a frequency?
If it wasn't at rest, that would still be the frequency, but it would be the frequency that you measure, which does not have to be the frequency I measure. The frequency of the guy sitting in the ambulance that is kind of telling everyone that is coming with a patient or going out of a patient doesn't change. Or that driver, you sitting on or standing on the sidewalk, your frequency changes. You have blue shift and red shift because first it's coming towards you, then it goes beyond you. That's not an invariant.
Yeah, okay, that's a scalar. If it is true in one inertial frame, it is true in other inertial frames. So that UAKA is always frequency.
This UA is a frequency. Yeah. So, but that will be the frequency that the observer that has that tangent measures. So these are our covariants. So now, then we put that aside. And now we recall, oh, but we do have a Killing field. And again, this is true regardless of what we're doing. And so they say, well, if there is a geodesic, whatever that is, and we dot it with that Killing field, we're going to have a constant. So that's what I'm going to use. So I'm going to come here and say, oh, a constant is given by the k dotted z. Then I use the fact that z is proportional to u. So I write that proportionality. And then I realize, oh, but there are pieces in here that if I put them together, it's a frequency. And that's what it is here. And then we still have to live with this extra piece, which is what now is measuring the redshift or the shift in frequency due to this photon moving in the gravitational potential. We go here and then go here.
I think Ka is not partial t, because it is not a dual vector.
Is it not a worry?
It's not a dual vector. It's not a dual vector.
It's not a dual vector?
It's not new.
No. Oh, this z.
K-A.
I didn't tell you. We've never used.
K-A is defined by partial t, partial a.
No. Okay. So sorry. This k. This way. Forget about it.
That's a Killing vector.
So that was a Killing vector. This is lowercase k. So lowercase k. So we hear that this is our Killing field. And this is our vector. This is our null vector. So it just so happened that, I mean, traditional, it is standard to denote the Killing vector because it starts with K, the name, with a capital K. It's also traditional to use a photon vector, also lowercase. So I'm using that lowercase. But this is why I said, oh, let's just call it Z for the time being. Any questions? Sorry about that mishap.
The way you solved it was very strongly contingent upon you using the Schwarzschild metric and calculating U naught and seeing, oh, OK, we have only U naught. And well, that actually corresponds to DDTA, which is the CA, and writing it like that. But if you were another metric, the general one.
Absolutely. So we, in a narrowed metric, we might not even have the Killing field. And this calculation would not work for what we're trying to do.
So what if they gave you a general metric with a lot of different functions, and they told you what would happen to my photon if I emit it here, and then I want to see what this frequency is there? There is not a general algorithm to find that frequency in another place?
No, you would have to iterate the geodesic, find the geodesic in place from whatever the first point is and the last point is. So we would be solving for this guy.
What if the number of Killing vectors is zero?
Exactly. Let's forget there are Killing vectors. I don't care there is a Killing field. There is none. So then I would go and then solve for this geodesic. Mm. And in fact, this will also be kind of illustrated in what we do next. We will solve for this guy. Okay. And out of that guy, we will then say, oh, now I have this observer that has UA. So that's local. I can always do that. And then see what this person measures, what that other observer measures, then we can compare.
So the analogy of this to classical physics would be we have two ways to, let's say, study a motion of a ball on the ground. We can either use conservation of energy.
Yes, exactly. Or you can do this. Yeah, so here, the great thing about having sufficient number of constants of motion is that we can bypass solving the problem in detail. We can just home in on what we're trying to do. But that's an excellent analogy. That's the easy analogy. And we're going to use it much more explicitly in what we do next. But the observation we were going after is this one. So we have the frequency that observer one kind of produces the photon with versus the frequency that observer two measures it. Depends on this thing. So let's say, for the sake of the argument, take R1 be very close to 2m. So you're emitting kind of on the surface of where this thing going to go. So this is very close to zero. So this is blowing up, which then says omega 1 is much, much larger than omega 2. And in fact, you can say omega 1 times, let's just do it explicitly here. So omega 2 essentially goes to zero if I bring R1 almost all the way to 2m. So we have a significant redshift. The photon, as far as the energy is concerned, is going to zero, right? And that's what you expect. If you have a space-time where there's a lot more pull here than over there, the photon will spend some of its energy or considerable amounts of its energy to climb up that potential well and get to the R observer. And this will relate to something that we'll discuss, the clock sticking. It's like the inverse of these. So something, so if an observer at very far is seeing that the frequency is going to zero, now the clock is 1 over the frequency, so the ticking near the R1, as it gets closer to the surface, essentially goes to zero. So we'll observe, an observer at far distances will never see someone fall into the black hole. But this is something we're going to discuss, or someone fall into R less than 2m. We have yet to talk about black holes. We're good? Okay, so that's the first, and this was one of the first tests that general relativity passed, or one of, not one of the first, it was measured in the 60s, but it was one of the first predictions.
What did they measure exactly here? Like, did they, because they weren't measuring like the photon frequency coming out of the
ball. Right. You prepare, like, you just, let's think of the simplest thing you could do. You have, you know, your hydrogen atom. You excite it, you know what the frequency should be, and then you ask your observer that is sitting in the space station, you're going to get a photon, tell me what frequency you measure. And then you compare Well, it is consistent with that.
So was it pretty redshifted?
Yeah, well, I mean, in the initial, the effect was small, but people have done it with quasars, and then you do it every day in your GPS.
Yeah.
Okay, so now let's go to some other effects. So we haven't even discussed yet geodesics. We just use a little bit. This goes to your point. We use only as much as we could. Okay, so this is what we could get away in this case. Let's do a little bit more. But very soon you're going to see that we're not even going to go all the way there. I'm not going to write shortshoot. I will misspell it. So we're going to consider two different types of geodesics, null and spacelike. So we know UA is equal, let's say, to minus one if it is, sorry, time-like. Zero, which is null. So if we have such an object, we also know that we can rewrite this. If now UA, let's imagine that is parameterized with a proper time, or with affine time rather, so that UA UB is equal to zero. So we could come and solve this. That would be the analog of what you were asking. But let's see if we can bypass it a little bit. How? It's because we have constants of motion. So we already discussed one. Now I'm going to come back with the time-like Killing field Ka to be ddt A. And then we have another one, which is, let's say, the phi A, dd phi A. Out of these two, let's imagine we define things that will be constant along the geodesics that are very convenient. So let's define one, and for obvious reasons, let's call it E, which will be just minus GAB KA UB. And again, sorry, I keep making these obvious statements, but I'm just drilling some things that come useful. It doesn't matter what order we have A and B because we have a symmetric tensor here, so it's the same. And then let's define L to be GAB IA UB. So we're using the two Killing fields for us. So this would be, if we use the definition of our metric, this expression, so where imagine UA is dx0 dt d tau. Let's use t for this. Dr d tau, d theta d tau, d phi d tau. What we can do. It's restrict because we're in perfectly spherical symmetry. We can always align things so that theta is constant. So we can even put a zero here. So we might have a particle that goes this way or this way and falls in or out of the potential. And of course, the coordinate time will be ticking because time passes by. So out of these, using our metric, you can show that this is R squared. I dot. And this is 1 minus 2m over r g dot. And by dot, I now mean this thing. So it's the derivative with respect to that our parameter tau. So we can just take a quick look what we're getting. This r squared phi dot. If I then write this as r times r phi dot, that's r times v, so this is like angular momentum. So this is a particle's angular momentum per unit mass. And of course, we're dealing with particles. The mass doesn't matter, so we don't need to worry about what the mass is. And this is essentially the energy of the particle. If I go very far out, you could imagine dt, d tau, and this we can prove explicitly goes to 1. So then this is the energy. At very far distances, if the particle is not moving, this goes to 0, this goes to 1, the energy goes to 1, or this E goes to 1, which is what you expect. The energy per unit mass of a particle that is in flat space-time, that is not moving, is exactly 1. Is that clear?
Choose d theta to be 0?
Because we're going to say, so you're going to see that this is spherical, especially it's perfectly spherically symmetric. So we could have a particle, of course, say it's doing this. So we'll change the theta. And we could also have the particle go like that, which would be changing both theta and phi. But then I just said, OK, just flip the axis so that I don't see any changes in theta. So then I can just particular take theta equal pi divided by 2, because that's what shows up in the line element, or did it go here? And so for all intents and purposes, it's just a 1. So we're just simplifying our life.
Oh, OK.
Any questions? Was the question here? No? OK. So now what we can do is to use this, use our metric, and begin to take into account that we can use this. So what we're using, if you want, having done this, let's just count. We have a normalization condition. That's condition number 1. We have 1, 2 constants. That's 3. And we have 3 unknowns, 1, 2, 3. So we can use all together to fully determine the problem without having solving the geodesics themselves.
Sorry, aren't there more non-zero components? Like if you had B and A were like, you know,
the
t component, the first component, why would that be
0? Wait, where did I say 0? So what?
You said L is only equal to r squared theta dot, and so the GAB, how are we defining phi? Oh, it's just that, never mind. Okay.
Yes, right. Okay. And there are more symmetries, which we're not carrying, because once we're adapting things in a particular way, we can discuss this later, but we're just looking at the minimum number of constants we can identify that we can take, we can exploit. And just by the counting we just did, we need 2 that are independent. So these 2 are independent from each other. I have the normalization condition, and now let's put all of these together. So if we write.
Why doesn't that have sine squared theta?
Because of that.
Oh, right.
No, great. Excellent question, because I should have said that, and I didn't say it. So now, this is going to do it as an exercise, but it's a very trivial exercise. Take this condition, and since we're really good, we can do 2 things at the same time. Let's do this equal to minus k. Oh, OK. Let's see, what do we? Minus kappa, I don't know. Well, that. And then this kappa would be either 1 or 0. If kappa happens to be 1, we're talking about a time-like geodesic. If it happens to be 0, we're talking about a null geodesic. So we're going to try and keep it as long as we can before we begin to do difference. So use this, use your metric, and use this together with this and that. So let me just kind of basically tell you what you will be doing. The metric, we have a metric that is diagonal. So we're going to have, when we expand this out, we're going to have a GTT UT square. UT is dt d tau. We have it square coming from there. But we can relate it to this guy, which is dt d tau. So use this guy to replace this guy when it enters over there. You can do the same thing with the phi d phi d tau. You can replace it when it enters here as you put in here. So once you do all that, you can arrive at the following equation, which is the following. So where the only unknown is the R dot. And then, but this will ring a bell. So this is 1/2 R dot square plus E of R equal E. I mean, in analogy to problems that you've done to death in classical mechanics. So without really solving explicitly the geodesic equations, we are able to use our constants of motion plus the normalization, which of course is an Nernst constant, to write things into now something that looks like a potential problem, so something that you would have solved.
Should that be E, not E squared?
That's E, sorry. No, that's E squared.
So is that
and then I'm calling it capital. Okay, why is E square? We are replacing the T, the tau that comes in normalization that comes square. So
half m squared is 4j squared.
Say again.
The kinetic term is V squared and E squared.
I mean, this E, so we're now calling to realize E square, call it, or 1/2 E square, call it curly E. And then this is what you would. Assigned to or thought about it from your Newtonian mechanics. But now, given that constant, because that E is a constant, okay, then what you're having is that 1/2 R dot square, which is the kinetic energy associated with the radial motion of a particle of unit mass or per unit mass, acted with or filling a potential under some constant of motion that you would say that's your energy. So if you had looked at what is the problem of a particle in Newtonian mechanics that goes around a circular object of mass m, or whatever, has some motion in that space-time, or in that situation, you also would have had angular momentum conservation and energy conservation. You would have obtained, if you use Newton's second law, essentially that very same rule, except that the potential would be slightly different. Let me just expand the potential. So if I just expand this out, my potential will be 1/2 k and sorry, my lowercase m turn into uppercase m and vice versa. The sometimes they get humble, they get egocentric, and they go up and down. So if you had looked at the Newtonian problem, the Newtonian problem would have had this piece with, of course, a 1, because that would have been a time-like trajectory. Would have that piece, that's the gravitational potential associated to your object. You could have this piece, that's the contribution of the centrifugal barrier. But this is new. So this is what GR brings into the mix that you wouldn't have had before. And of course, this changes qualitatively in the right regime, everything. Of course, if you have no angular momentum, okay, that goes away, and you have what you had before. But if you have angular momentum, this goes there. But notice that the existence or not of this term changes the potential completely. If you look at the potential, and again, think of IL non being 0, at sufficiently small r's, these terms dominate. It just blows up in the positive direction. But now when you consider that, it blows up in the negative direction. So you would have, well, in this case, a centrifugal barrier gave you a maximum or a minimum r that a particle could get to before it bounced back. Here, there is a point where of no return. It would just fall in if there is sufficient contribution of this L. Yes?
Significant change if we use like a more accurate metric.
Absolutely. I mean, for instance, if you had, I mean, accurate with respect to the physical scenario you're considering. So in nature, you wouldn't expect things to not have any angular momentum. So Schwarzschild, the Schwarzschild metric over there has no angular momentum. In fact, we could argue, even though it has lots of nice stability problems, Schwarzschild is unstable. You drop a dot, a particle with an angle, it will fall in. It will change the mass of the black hole in essentially nothing. But now it took it from a spherically symmetric situation with zero angular momentum with a little bit of angular momentum. So that takes you into a narrow solution, which is a Kerr solution. We're not going to discuss that much, but you're going to see a length in January. But that one, indeed, that would be the case. So we're, this is a tremendous simplification. However, you could say, well, for what's the contribution of an angular momentum intrinsic to the system, intrinsic to the central object? It's subleading. It goes like 1 over r squared. So it modifies this a little bit, but by and large, it's a small effect. Of course, people have measured that effect. There is frame dragging, so you have something over there just because the central object is rotating, we'll drag it with it. And this again has been also tested and demonstrated that the expectations from within GR are right on the money. But yeah, that's an excellent question. We're just simplifying this. We're talking about our spherical cow. We're going 1, 2, 3.
Could you please repeat about those lowercase m?
Lowercase m is my idiotic way of not being able to keep track of uppercase m and lowercase m. M is the same as m. It's the mass of the central object. Sorry, as you can see, I'm not just Greek challenged. I'm also Latin challenged. Two?
With the efficient enough initial energy, it seems like there's nothing that prevents particles to move. Escape from the event horizon just from that equation. So how can we?
We'll see. We're gonna get there. You'll see that. In fact, it's gonna be problematic. And also will depend. Well, the event horizon, they will not be able to, because otherwise we'll have to. The velocity that we'll measure will be faster than the speed of light. But we're gonna go there. So hold on to that thought. You had a question here.
So. The E that you define here is not energy, right?
Yeah, it is the analog of the energy.
Because E squared is here.
That's here. But over there, that's what the observer would measure. Here it's just saying you have a structure that looks like the one you would have discussed in Newtonian mechanics. So we have a constant. Just think of it as a constant. And then the analysis you could do would be very similar to the analysis you would do in Newtonian.
You said that this is falling in, and because that is there is a minus term there, because for that to be valid, this has to be potential energy.
Right, but the other thing is, remember, this E is energy per unit mass. The unit mass, and we're thinking of a particle that is at infinity, is at rest, has energy 1, and so that still is 1. So it doesn't matter where we have E or E squared. That 1/2 is funny, but you can. I mean, your worry is that, okay, this is not the same as energy.
Yeah.
It's some barrier that is related to the energy, and then we're going to be able to discuss what the particle does. And in the slow motion limit, we can recover very close to what you already know from Newtonian mechanics, except that this term will be there. But of course, as you take the mass to be kind of small angular momentum, the role of this will be less and less relevant, except that at sufficiently small r's, this will dominate. But we had said that we can only look at sufficiently small r's provided your object is within that small r, right? So otherwise, then it's a different metric that you'll be discussing.
You said E is equal to 1 here?
Well, think of that E, just think of that E, and go asymptotically. So imagine you drop a particle at an infinite far distance, at rest. So 2m over r is 0. And t is the, so what is that t? Is the rate at which
inertial, basically, you're saying an infinite.
At infinite distance, it's flat. So this d
is also 1.
It also goes to 1. So then the whole thing is evaluates to 1. And you see, as we describe a little bit more, you'll see this 1 coming up. OK, so let's see. Who in the second row has not said answer the three questions? Yeah, then we move to the third row. Okay, so let's go third row. Start with you.
I'm Pia. It's
I like reading books.
Cool.
My name is Cole. My free time, I like to bother my friends with my wild physics ideas and for them to tell me why I'm wrong. And play guitar. This is true.
Physics harassment, great.
I'm Rokas. I am from the US and I like to go hiking.
Oh, sorry, we don't have much here, but there's something in the escarpment or something, but it might not be up to the standards. Where from the US?
San Diego.
Oh, you don't have many places there. Well, okay, some. Okay, thank you. okay, let's look at a few things. So first, let's just stick to the case where Curly is one. So we're looking at time-like geodesic. And again, don't confuse that this is a plus one, because we actually define it with a minus over there. So we're already taking into account that the time-like geodesic should be a normal minus one. Now, what does this, let me just draw the potentials effectively. And let's first just think of trying to look at this potential and find where its extrema are. I mean, if you remember your Newtonian mechanics, wherever you had extrema, that always was an interesting point, either because it will.
Sorry, can go back to the.
Yeah.
You said E is equal to 1 when R goes to infinity, and that's fair. But the analogy that you're using here for the potential energy is for as small as you get, as small as you can get with respect to R.
No, so if you imagine, just you can picture that there's a particle that you draw up from infinity, and then you're just seeing it go as it gets closer and closer, and it falls, and then that's where we make connection. No, but keep those questions coming. But the constant will still be there. So now we're just thinking of this, looking at the maxima and minima of potential, because that will always determine things where when brackets are our potential motion. So we just take dv dr and ask where is this is zero. So if we take that and analyze it, you're going to reach that the potential goes to zero at two places. So let's call it r plus and r minus. I'm using now my r became a big r just because of that special place, or we'll just call it R plus and R minus, at the following. So there are two places where we could have extrema, but then, okay, immediately just out of here, we realize that if L squared is less than 12 m squared, the discriminant is negative, and therefore we have imaginary responses. So in this scenario, we don't have extrema. We have something that at far distances, if we go very far, okay, this all goes to zero, so it's going to 1/2. Here, and this goes back to, in some sense, to your question. The energy is one. We have a 1/2 e squared. Well, e squared doesn't change anything, but there was a 1/2. Well, okay, we're compensated with this 1/2 here. So it goes to over there to 1/2. But as we go to a smaller and smaller r, this potential does that. So if we don't have enough angular momentum, in particular, if we drop the particle here, it just shoots all the way into and ties into whatever the core of this object may be.
Sorry, what's the vertical axis?
So this is potential on R. And related to questions, this we can look in detail. If you then take L equal, also where does this potential cross zero? It's a 2m. So the R one is now if L squared is greater than 12 m squared. Now we have a different situation. We have a minima and a maxima. The minima, the potential, has a bucket. And then the maxima, okay, has a peak. And you can see that roughly the potential will be given by behavior goes. So we have a minima here, let's call it R plus, and a maxima here, call it R minus. So we have a situation where if we have sufficient angular momentum, we could have a particle that comes into some place and then bounces back and goes to infinity. You expect that, so you have this kind of scenario. Another one, if you have more energy than that, then you can just fall in and not be determined. So if there is a relation, there has to be a relation between the angular momentum that the particle has and the total mass of the spacetime. So we can look at it with a bit more detail. We can ask for limiting cases. So we can ask, what happens if L happens to be exactly equal, L squared happens to be exactly equal to 12M squared?
If R goes to infinity, you don't have positive.
So if R goes to infinity, I have to look at here. So if R goes to infinity, it goes to 1/2 K. So same thing.
Anyway.
Say again.
Over the r-axis, like, does it become positive again?
So it becomes positive because there is a fight in between this guy and that guy, mm-hmm. but eventually that one dominates.
Wait, but at very large r, does it go over the r-axis?
So if we go take very large r, then all these is irrelevant, and you have that contribution.
At what point does it cross?
We can just you just have to say fix everything and choose v equal to zero. That will give you the answer. And then the R2 is the minimum and the maximum is wherever the gradient of it with respect to R goes to zero. So what I wanted to do is just take that limiting case, 12 L squared 12 M squared. And then you can ask what R plus is. So R plus in that case okay, so what was this R plus? So R plus, remember, if we had a trajectory that was circular, so where R dot is equal to zero, if you're sitting right at the bottom of the potential, you could have orbits that are circular by construction, but also they are stable. That's a key thing. And they are stable because, okay, you see that this is kind of the potential varies in this way. You move it a little bit and it will just do at most oscillations around it, but this will be stable. On the other hand, that one would be completely unstable. You make it a little bit of give it a little perturbation in R, and either will fly off to infinity or fall into oblivion. And so this is new. You didn't have this. So this is, says that the minimum radii at which you can sustain stable circular trajectories is 6m.
Are you saying this is new as opposed to like
Newtonian? Okay. In Newtonian, you didn't have that. You could also do this, the calculation is slightly more delicate because you have to take limits. I mean, in this case, if I'm taking the limit, this one going to zero from above and from below, or when you take the plus and minus, you have to kind of work out the next order. But you can, if you do that, or we can discuss maybe on Friday during lunch, that R minus, which is where they are unstable orbit, R minus are always between 3m and 6m. Okay. So the unstable circular orbits for particles would be between 3m and 6m. Inside of them, then you fall into the horizon into the black or into the object that we have yet to discuss.
You said that r minus is in general between 3m, 6m,
yeah.
Not when l squared is.
Right, that's not so when you can.
Because that,
that's right, in general, so in general. This is true.
Why? Why is that?
Oh, over there.
Can you draw the graph for this one?
Say again?
Can you draw the graph for this one?
Or which one?
With L squared goes to 12.
So we would just be doing this.
Is it the same one?
It would be the same one, except that this one is sitting at 6m.
Okay.
This, incidentally, goes is connected to your previous question you asked. If we had rotation in this object, now we would have two different types of orbits. You could be co-rotating with the system or counter-rotating from with the system. So you could be, so you have an object that is moving in this direction. You could have a particle that moves along the same directions or in the opposite direction. That is different if you have net rotation in your space-time. So the analog of this guy has two different values. One value is associated to co-rotating orbits. The other one is associated with counter-rotating orbits. But in this case, we're analyzing because it's spherically symmetric. Doesn't make a difference.
Stay the same. You don't have the r minus and r plus are the same thing. So at that point, your dvdr is zero, and then you go down. You don't go up again.
I don't know, sorry, which?
For this graph, the case that r plus is 6m.
Yes.
If r plus is 6m, meaning l to the fourth minus 12, l squared, m squared is zero.
Yes.
So that's the general. You have one r.
That's right.
So after r plus, you just go down.
Yes.
You don't go up again.
Well, you go and then you do this.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and then they come together.
Can we draw that?
Can I not do that? Can I do it? Let me think about it and I'll give you the graph next class.
Okay.
Let me just do one more thing that I wanted to do here, which is related to what we just discussed. So now if you imagine you're here, you're stable, and we said that if you perturb it a little bit, you're going to have oscillations that go left and right in between two kind of neighboring points. Yes?
Your r plus is 6m, but you knew that you crossed the r axis at r equal to 2m.
No, no, I didn't say that. That was here.
But that's always true.
I have to do the calculation.
If you said r equal to 2m, that is always 0.
R equal to 2m, so let's do.
If you want. The first two terms cancel each other.
R divided by, sorry, these two cancel and this one two cancel. Yes, good. Then it crosses
so
at 2m.
First crossing is R equal to 2m.
And then it crosses 0.
So that's, okay, so it's the on the left side. So the other crossing
is
the right side. So I don't know what happens on the right-hand side.
Yeah, let me just do this graph much better. I have it for Friday. We'll discuss it. Let me just finish in the last few minutes this thing that I wanted to connect with. So if we are sitting here at a stable orbit, and we imagine that we perturb it ever so slightly, what's going to happen? So if this is our circular orbit, imagine you perturb it a little bit, then what you're going to have is a new orbit that kind of does this, right? And then it may or may not close in the same place. And it will close in the same place if two things happen. Well, if one thing's happened, either essentially, the frequency of oscillation around the r direction matches, at least with some number of integer, with some integer number, with the frequency associated to going around in a circle. Right? So if that's true, then you could have something that closes. So what we're trying to do is reach out to the test of the perihelion of Mercury. And there, if you want to see the full analysis, I suggest look at Carroll's. But a reasonably kind of self-contained, succinct description is in Wald. So I'm just giving you Wald's version. So we keep an eye on the money. The money is we have Mercury. We see that it's almost closing the ellipse, but there is a little bit of a precession. So the case where it's like not this very deformed one. We have something that where the orbits, where the orbit kind of almost go this way, you can barely appreciate that it's different from a circle, and then it doesn't close just by a little bit. So here you're talking about the one. Just this, there are multiple oscillations. It's a very low frequency change of the orbit. So what we're asking is, does this happen? If these two were the same, we wouldn't see any precession whatsoever. If they are different, there is. So you can say the delta in omega is the precession frequency. And so it's comparing this with that. So what we can do is, well, first compute what omega r is. Omega r is associated with perturbations around the bottom of the potential, and that is always given by the second derivative of the potential. So you can compute the second derivative of the potential with respect to r twice gives you that omega r. Right? You can always approximate that potential by sufficiently close by something that has the minimum of the potential leading order, the derivative of the potential is zero, and we have one half this object, this second derivative square, so you're approximated essentially by a little spring in there. And the strength of the spring is related by the second derivative. You remember that from classical mechanics? Okay, so following that, you get this, and this is m over r plus. We're sitting on r plus. But so this we get from assuming a small perturbation in the radial direction. This we get from our constant, and we can compare omega r now with the square of this omega. And so we can define using the precession frequency, which is omega phi minus omega r. And you can follow this through. This is 1 minus 6m over r plus, the 1 half. So you just have to rearrange the terms. So this is an exercise. And if you can't derive it, ask me. It's not that complicated. Just take the square root of this one minus that one and express in terms of omega phi, you get that. And now, if we're thinking again of Mercury and the Sun, we can think that r plus is much, much larger than the mass. And so you can just take the leading order contribution of that. And when you find this, Wp is roughly 3m to the 3 halves divided by r plus the 5 halves. And then if we want to put true units, okay, then we have to do 3gm the 3 halves c square r plus to the 5 halves. Okay, so what we have now computed again is that these would be related to that little change per unit time, if you want, of the orbit that now doesn't meet, doesn't close at the same point. This is not exactly for Mercury, because Mercury's orbit is slightly elliptical. So this actually receives a change. You're going to see the semi-major axis. But by and large, you can just think of this term. and then think of what would the unit or the amount that this will have as a correction is tiny. It's very tiny, even if you think that kind of take the average orbit, the average size of the Mercury's orbit. But in a very long time, it adds up. And so this is what was one of the, or perhaps the main first result of general relativity predicting something that was correct. This with light bending, which is Mercury doesn't close its orbit by 43 arc seconds in a century. It's a ridiculously small number, but it's a number nevertheless. And historically, this was very important because people till that point were trying to kind of account for this effect by a yet-to-be-seen planet. This has been a recipe that has been very successful in the past. Satellites of planets were found by seeing the trajectory of some objects not quite add up. Oscillating, there was another object that you didn't see of a given mass at a given distance, and then accounted for that. So people were doing this for Mercury's, and this is how the planet Vulcan was created. And then later on, we got an annoying character in a weird sci-fi series. But this is that calculation. Of course, if you do that for an elliptic orbit, then this actually turns into, and this is where I'd say, check Carol go through this, through the derivation. So that you have the eccentricity accounted for, A is a semi-major axis, but by and large, the scaling is the same. So the last thing I want to say, what we're going to put the numbers and then draw these pictures better, is once we study now photons or null geodesics, we choose that kappa equal to zero, and it will be an analogous quantity of the 6m or this r plus and r minus. In fact, there will be only one, and this will be trajectories for photons, and we're going to determine there is something special in this geometry at 3m, which is a photon orbit. So it's the last stable circular orbit. Sorry, that's unstable. The last unstable circular orbit for photons sits at 3m. And this is where it's like the EHT, Event Horizon Telescopes, uses to try and measure the mass of an object. Just taking images and finding where is some non-trivial amount of emission that is the tightest, closer to the black hole. So as a half joke, I actually complain about the name Event Horizon Telescope because the EHT does not see the event horizon. It's something that is close by, but if you test that and it's sufficiently accurate, then you say, well, if this is here, then an event horizon is close by, and I can use what I measure close by to try and test the geometry, and out of that, infer what the geometry closer to what would be the black hole should be.
So r is equal to 2m is very short distance, but there's another r where the potential vanishes. So,
right, vanishing the potential is not special. I mean, well, there, it's special for a reason, but with respect to what we're trying to compute here, where is the last stable orbit that you can have, thinking of circular orbit or unstable, so those are special points. The zero of the potential is not special in any significant way because, well, we have energy. So that will tell you that when the potential vanishes, so the energy associated to the particle is fully encoded, say, in the radial motion. But that's it.
Why did you say that R plus was much greater than M?
No, I see, well, for Mercury? Yeah, because we're talking about the sun. So our sun, remember you told me the other day what the radius of the sun was?
700,000 kilometers.
Right. Which is way, I mean, so it's,
yeah.
And M is that location where R will be, where we will have the event horizon. So M, in units of M, a solar mass is 1.5 kilometers. So we're way, so Mercury is sitting way outside. So then we can just use that to say M over R is essentially zero. So we're doing a calculation of the first order in M over R. Any other question? Okay, we'll stop here. And then next class, we'll talk about this, a little bit more about an R test. And then we're going to try to then fix this problem that we notice with our coordinates, and then use kind of the quote-unquote resolution to begin to make contact with now what we would call a black hole. So far, the only thing we know is that there is something funny going on at R equal to M. We're going to put quantities associated to that.